ball, pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
And strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager, that just happened. Thank you very much.
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
And welcome back to the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Gary Hill back with you. Thanks for being here on a Friday. Off day yesterday, but I think we're all still basking in the glorious glow that was the Iwakuma no-hitter just a couple of days ago at Safeco Field. So the Mariners right back in action today. So we're going to talk about that in a second as they're in Boston to take on the Red Sox for the first of three games. So we'll touch on that in a moment. We have a lot to get to in this one. Finally, bullpen banter this week. It's taken me all week to get there, but here we are. Bullpen banter is on its way. Charlie Furbush, he's with Brad Miller this time around. We're going to hear from a Hall of Famer. Aaron Goldsmith chatted with Jim Palmer. Always a great conversation. Man, the history. It's good. It's good. That's coming up. I had a chance to talk to the play-by-play announcer for the Bakersfield Blaze. This is a very interesting conversation and a couple names you need to know with the Bakersfield Blaze. So that comes up in a few minutes as well. Shannon Dreyer caught up with Franklin Gutierrez about how things are going, and they're going pretty well for him. So she'll talk to Franklin Gutierrez in just a second. But the Mariners taking on the Red Sox, and this should be a fascinating series. The Mariners playing their best baseball of the season. They've won seven of their past 10 ball games. They've won a couple in a row. They've taken another series. After losing the first against Baltimore, they take the next two to win the series. And now they take on a Red Sox team with the worst record in the American League, sitting right now at 50-64. They're 4-6 in their last 10. They've lost two in a row. They just lost their closer, Uehara, who got nailed with a line drive, hurt his wrist. He's going to be out for the season. They've traded Mike Napoli. The rotation has really struggled. They've had their issues. So this is going to be in a very interesting weekend, I think, for the Mariners. First one tonight, Mike Montgomery will take the hill. He's going to go against Joe Kelly, who has struggled for the most part this season, but had one of his best two starts last time out. And he was able to mix his pitches, which they've been trying to get him to do this season, mix his pitches a little bit more. He did it last time out against the Tigers. Will he do it today against the Mariners? That's the question. Montgomery, how will he bounce back after a tough start last time out in Fenway Park, which can be tough for lefties from time to time? So that's going to be interesting. A lot to watch with this one. Will Nelson Cruz be back in the lineup after the day off and then an off day? And the bullpen, of course, that's a storyline. They get 2 days off as well. So a lot to look at with the game tonight and with the weekend series against the Red Sox as the Mariners go for another series. 4:10 first pitch. We'll take the air at 3:00 for the pregame show. I hope you join us for what should be a fun series over the weekend against the Red Sox. Right now, though, we're going to hand things over to Charlie Furbush. It is time for Bullpen Banter.
Hey, we're back again with another edition of Bullpen Banter. Holy cow. And we're back. Anyways, today, I'm Charlie Furbush for all the people that are still listening. Today, my special guest is Brad Miller, the wonderful Brad Miller. How are you today, man?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Oh, outstanding. Another beautiful day here in C-Town. Let me ask, how was your off day?
Off day was good, you know, just relaxing, getting back in town, getting acclimated, situated. Yeah, it was good, resting up and ready to go.
Nice, man. Did you get some laundry done?
Laundry was done, yes.
Wow, it's a key part of our lives, you know what I mean? Do you have a preference of detergent?
I don't. I got those little pod things. You just throw them in, you know, no mess, just pretty easy.
Where did it all start for you, man?
It all went down in a little town called Orlando, Florida. You know, I love it. I'm a Florida boy at heart, but I grew up in the Sunshine State.
Absolutely. Give me your favorite amusement park, favorite water park.
Favorite water park, easy. Blizzard Beach. It's one of the Disney ones, and it is awesome. and had a bunch of field trips there, and you just run off and, you know, lose your chaperone.
Yes.
And, yeah, the lazy river all around the whole place. Blizzard Beach is awesome. Favorite amusement park, Islands of Adventure, but I don't like rides or anything, so no. I'm scared.
Do you get, like, really motion sickness?
Yeah, motion sickness and just general fright. But, yeah, so Blizzard Beach is where it's at.
Give me your experience or your thoughts on hitting 3 home runs in a game. I know you've come close. When you've hit 2 home runs in a game, do you just go up to the last at-bat saying, I'm going for a homer?
I remember in Tampa 2 years ago when I hit 2, and then my 3rd one I flew out to the warning track. That's probably obviously the closest I've been. Yeah, I mean, home runs are honestly the funnest, coolest thing ever. I don't know how many chances I've had to go for the 3rd one, but, yeah, I mean, you, as a hitter, you're always on the attack wanting to drive something and do some damage. But, yeah, I think, you know, when guys hit 3, I mean, that's crazy. I know Chris Woodward, I always give him a hard time about it and always bring it up because I think it's the coolest thing ever. But he hit 3 homers. Mike Cameron hit 4 here. Like, that's really cool.
You're the only person, I think, on our team that hit one in the 3rd deck at Coors Field in BP. Did you not know that?
I mean, I was definitely trying to get it up there.
Well, you got it up there. I saw maybe the 1st or 2nd row. It was a bomb, but no one else even got up there, man.
I think Nuno
actually got up there.
Yeah, Nuno. Yeah, he got a nice little hit. Pitchers really had a nice showing in Colorado.
Do you think we can hit, or is it like, do you think all pitchers are just completely unathletic?
No, I mean, there's some guy, Nuno, that was awesome. Taiwan doubled on the line. I think he could have got a triple if that guy didn't catch it.
Easy triple.
Yeah, the only guy that can't hit is Montgomery. He thinks he can, but he can't.
Yeah, I would agree with you. He talks a big game, but when it comes to execution, it's kind of pretty tough.
He acts like the ball he hit in San Diego was, like, hardest hit ball in the century.
Yeah, he wanted to look at StatCast because he thought he hit so hard. If there was a movie made after you, what actor would be playing the movie of your life?
I've always said Jim Carrey because when I had the hair going in college, all my buddies would call me Ace Ventura.
Okay, is that your favorite Jim Carrey movie?
Liar, Liar.
Oh, see, I'm so glad you said that. That's an underrated, amazing, amazing flick.
It's a saff, yeah. That's a good flick.
Sweet, Jim Carrey. That's what it is. Yeah. Does Jim Carrey have a actress maybe that would be the love interest of Jim Carrey? You know, like who would be your celebrity crush as a female?
It would probably be, you know, like maybe a Blake Lively, maybe a Selma Hayek type. I don't know.
Wow. That's impressive. Yeah. Impressive. So if you didn't play baseball, what other sport would you be playing?
Wow. I really was into basketball growing up, played that into high school. That would be really cool. No chance football, maybe like a punter or something. Something that doesn't get hit.
I mean, you more of a field goal kicker than a punter.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, I kick left-footed, you know, maybe that. But I don't know. I was really pretty serious into basketball until I was not anymore.
But, there you go.
Yeah.
What is your go-to karaoke song? If you were going to go out to a karaoke place, go-to.
Yeah, that's easy because over the years on the bus, I've had to perform numerous jingles. And I think the go-to, though, is Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice.
Ding, 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 da-da-ding, ding.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 da-da-ding, ding. Ice Ice Baby.
Yep. You know, I got a little Vanilla Ice in me. I will not perform it here because it's traumatizing performing on the bus. Like, I'm not a karaoke legend like my mom, you know. She's got that's her thing, and I did not carry over.
Wow, she's a legend.
Whenever the karaoke machine gets broke out at the Miller house, you know it's been a good night.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she didn't transfer any of those genes, you know.
I mean none.
Like, stop, collaborate, and listen.
I know.
Ice is back with a brand new invention. Something
grabs a hold of me tightly.
You know. That's all. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up with this week's edition of Bullpen Banter. And I will get Ice Ice Baby out of Brad or his mother because apparently she's a legend. Hope you're listening to this, Mom. It's been a great show. Thanks for coming on, Brad.
Thank you.
All right, we're out. We'll see you guys next week.
And we've talked a lot of Mariners present. How about some Mariners future? Now we get a chance to visit with a guy I've wanted to visit for a while now, a new organization in the Mariners organization we haven't had a chance to visit with. It's Dan Bespris, assistant general manager, play-by-play announcer of the Bakersfield Blaze. Dan, thanks for taking the time. It's really great to have you on and finally get a chance to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Gary. And from this day forward, anytime, I promise. You want me on, I'll be ready to go.
I appreciate that. I'll take you up on that for sure. Well, Bakersfield, you guys have been playing some good ball in August, but this is the first time we've had a chance to talk to you and get to know Bakersfield as an organization. Tell us a little bit about the Blaze as an organization.
Well, I think the Blaze, we sort of pride ourselves on being a little weird. And I know that's maybe not the best first word to use when describing yourself, because there's a lot of an obsession with brand these days. But our brand is, we kind of lean into it. We have a backwards-facing ballpark. It's a 74-year-old facility, and it gets a bad rap around minor league baseball, but it's our weird little place, and we take a lot of pride in it, and I think we've got it sort of ready to go for family entertainment out here. And you know what? We play at sea level, and the wind blows in, so pitchers are, I think, pretty happy to be in Bakersfield this year.
Well, that's pretty interesting, because how different is that compared to the rest of the ballparks around the league in terms of the ball flying out and good places to hit?
You know, it's funny. Our ballpark, it's 357 feet of straightaway center field, which is the shortest, I think, in the world. But yet we're kind of middle of the pack when it comes to the California League. And pitchers have had a lot of success here at home this season. And I don't think that's in any small part due to the fact that last year they had to throw a lot of their games at 3,000 feet altitude with wind blowing out, and consequently an infield that kind of turned into concrete by mid-season. So, you know, by all accounts, we should be a very hitter-friendly ballpark. And aside from those nights, and there will be a few throughout the summertime, there have been a couple and there'll be a couple more, where it stays hot until, you know, 2, 3 in the morning and the ball jumps a little bit, it actually plays relatively fair. And I know that's, it's surprising, but it led to a little more of a balanced attack this year.
Interesting. And you mentioned the history. I mean, there's a lot of history with the Blaze, including some great players down on through the years, including Don Drysdale, some Hall of Famers on that list.
Yeah, we got another Hall of Famer this year, actually. Pedro Martinez came up through Bakersfield. So we got two now. And you're right. I mean, there's a ton of history, and it's all in this very same ballpark, which – it's kind of neat. And, you know, I'll admit we don't have the bells and the whistles. We don't have shade, which is a real problem other than a couple of picnic areas. But there's something to be said for kind of old-fashioned baseball, where there's going to be one promotion, whether it's fireworks or a giveaway or, you know, a dollar beverage or something that fans will come into the ballpark to have. And despite, like I said, that this place does get a bad rap, if you talk to the fans that actually come to the ball games, they pretty much unanimously would say they had a really good time. And, yeah, it'd be nice to have some of the newer facilities, but it's really quite serviceable, and it's not as bad as people think.
Well, it's been a good time for Bakersfield in the month of August, 5-1 this month so far. What's made Bakersfield so good in the month of August?
You know, it's tough to say, because there's been still those little mistakes here and there, and that'll happen because it is A-ball, and guys are learning, and sometimes you have to learn from goofing it up a couple of times. But things have come together a little bit more at the right time, where maybe in, I don't want to even really talk about May. That was a tough month. But if you talk about June and July, where the team was sort of steadily losing about one or two more games every couple of weeks than they were winning. Well, if they'd hit one day, they'd score 7 runs, but they'd lose 8-7. And there'd be a day where they didn't hit, but they'd pitch, and they'd lose 3-2. So they just weren't happening at the right time. And all of a sudden now, over the last week, on the days when the team is hitting, they're pitching well enough to win. Yesterday, the team didn't hit but for a Nelson Ward solo home run, but they pitched, and they won 1-0. And so little things like that, it makes a big difference. And the stat I think that most folks can kind of hang on with this Blaze team, where they say, well, maybe it's not quite as bad as it looks down there, is the one run finishes, the one-run differential games, where the Blaze, prior to last night, were 10-24 in games decided by one run. So a ton of close ball games, and unfortunately, they haven't won very many of them. So, you know, if this team scores, you can do the math of about an extra 24 runs, or maybe double that and give them 48, they could be a 500 or better ball club. So it's that close to being a good team. And in this month of August so far, those little things have happened where they're now winning close games, and then you sort of add that to the easier victories, and they've won 5 out of 6.
One guy that's really caught my eye, Tyler O'Neill, who looks like he has been absolutely on fire here for the past couple of weeks. What have you seen from O'Neill?
He's a monster. I mean, he's an absolute gorilla. He's 5'10", and he's about 210 pounds of just pure muscle. And my favorite thing was when I picked up that Mariners media guide to start the year and kind of prep and find out about some of the guys coming to Bakersfield, and it listed that Tyler's dad was the former Mr. Canada. I thought, well, how big could his kid really be? Well, he's huge, and he's got that deep voice to match it. But beyond that, just beyond the way he looks when he takes the field, he is just power-wise a rare breed. And there are a lot of guys in the Cal League that will hit 20 home runs and, you know, the chip shots. They'll knock them into out in High Desert and in Lancaster. They'll get it up into the breeze or in a place like Stockton or here in Bakersfield. You hit a line drive, and if you flip one 325 feet to right field, you can just barely drop it out of the ballpark, a couple of short porches. Those have not been the home runs that O'Neill's hit this year. I mean, they are moonshots over video boards, into batters' eyes. It's been unbelievable the kind of home runs he's hit this season. Towering shots that you watch enough minor league games, you start to think, well, that's going to be a fly ball to shallow left. And it just keeps going and going. And, you know, suddenly it's 420 feet away. He has a rare amount of power that I haven't seen come through Bakersfield. But for Yasmani Grandal, who was here with the Reds about 4 or 5 years ago, and then I think Justin Upton, when I saw him come through Visalia almost a decade ago, where they just hit the ball and it explodes, and before you know it, it's into the next field over.
That's pretty good company.
That's very good company. He's got to cut down on the swings and misses a little bit, but again, he's only 20, which is, I mean, 20-year-olds aren't supposed to be able to hit a ball that far.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. What kind of outfielder is he?
He's quick. I don't think he gets enough credit for his other ability, and maybe that's my own fault, too, for talking about his power too much. But he has a very good first step. He is, you know, he plays like you'd think a guy of his stature would play. He'll dive for everything. He'll face plant trying to make a catch. There's never a dull moment with Tyler O'Neill. And on top of all of that, he's actually, and this is more, again, on the offensive side, he's 16 for 16 in stolen bases. He hasn't been caught this year.
Wow.
So a couple more of those, and he'll be a 2020 kid. He's really been impressive. And, again, if he starts to take a few more pitches, I can't even imagine. The sky's the limit.
Wow, that's a great report. Now, another outfielder, Austin Wilson, who I saw a lot at Stanford and was always impressed with his tools. The overall numbers don't jump off the page, but you look at him lately, I mean, 3-plus hits in 3 of his past 5 games. It looks like he's really streaking right now.
Yeah, he's reached base in 7 games in a row. He's starting to get to the inside pitch. And, you know, talking to Max Venable, our hitting coach down here this year, it brought a grin ear to ear to his face when I asked about just that. And it's the kind of thing where you figure asking a hitting coach, you get a, you know, a long-winded reply. You might hear a sigh of some sort. He was just thrilled that somebody noticed it. For Austin this year, and this is something that I think has been said about Stanford products as a whole, they teach their kids up there to, I guess that'd be down there for you guys, huh?
To
kind of inside out the ball a little bit, a lot of right field approach. And for a guy of Wilson's stature, with his strength and his ability, to hit the ball only to right field is an intense waste. He's a monster. He's 6'5", 245, and he's athletic. So if you got a guy of that size and you can teach him how to turn on a ball, like O'Neill, he's a guy that's going to hit it into another century. And that's finally starting to happen. And, you know, I could tell Austin's one of the smartest guys that I think's ever come through Bakersfield or any minor league city. It was really wearing on him. You know, he was batting 195 for 3.5 months of a high A season. He hadn't really been hurt this year, knock on something, which is great for him because that injuries had derailed him a little bit over the last couple of years. But it was on the last homestand, I guess that'd be about 10, 11 days ago, he got a fastball middle in, and he hit it so far over the left field wall that everybody stopped and watched. But more than anything, it was a fastball, and he was able to get it to the pull side of the field. And then all of a sudden, everything started clicking. It was just like he needed to feel it happen one time. He went bonkers in Lancaster, which is a great place to hit. The one thing that's interesting about Wilson, he leads the league in being hit by a pitch. so he's a pincushion. He's been hit 19 times this year.
Wow.
But you know what? He's another guy that kept his head up. He played great outfield defense even when he wasn't hitting. And he's an easy guy to root for. And to see his average spike 30 points in 15 days is very rewarding. And I think now we've got 4 weeks left. If he can keep it going down the stretch, then he's in good shape. It's a testament to perseverance this year.
Yeah, no, that's great. What about, I know fans are really interested in Justin Seager for obvious reasons. What have you seen from Justin?
Yeah, Justin is, and I'll preface anything I say about the swing with the following comment. He might very well be the nicest human being I've ever met. Mm-hmm. He's always the first one to say hello. He's always asking how everybody's doing. He's a fantastic team guy, but he has struggled a little bit this year. He got a lot of playing time in the first half. And there was a stretch in mid-June where it looked like things were starting to come around a little bit. And I think, and I may have this wrong, he was either first or second on the team in doubles at that point. But something seems to have sort of unclicked itself over the last couple of weeks. And he could just be pressing now, kind of coming down the stretch, sort of trying to earn back a little bit of playing time that may have gone the way of Kyle Petty, because he's been hitting the ball a little bit better. Again, another guy that's just unbelievably easy to root for, and there's a lot of hope. He's a big, strong kid. He's working on trying to square that thing up, but it has been a little bit of a struggle this year for Justin, and he's just going to keep grinding away at it.
Is there anyone else Mariner fans should keep their eyes on?
You know, it's funny. I'm trying to, before you called, I took a few minutes to look over our pitching staff, because they've been so good and so consistent all year. But, you know, the flamethrowers, the hard-throwing guys, the electrifying pitches, those guys were all called up to Double-A in April and May. In Edwin Diaz, Trey Cochran-Gill, Paul Fry went up right around the minor league all-star break. The guys that were striking everybody out. What you've got now is a pitching staff of just 12 guys that get people out, and each one kind of in their own unique way. As the bullpen goes, you know, the Mariners signed a kid out of independent ball named Kyle Scapel, who was in Visalia last year, and he bounced around quite a bit. And all of a sudden now he's sort of taken over as the closer on this team. Rafael Pineda, a 30-some-odd rounder, has been arguably the most consistent reliever for the team all season, and he's throwing 90-91 with a little bit of sink. So, you know, that there's more than one way to skin a cat, I guess. As starters go, I've been pretty impressed with Dan Altafilla. He's had a couple of blips over the course of the season, but, you know, again, young guys, they're going to have those days where they just don't have their stuff. But, you know, he's throwing 92 to 94 as a starter. He's got a big breaking ball. And, you know, once the consistency sets in, that'll be, of course, the big key for a lot of young guys. I think Dan's the kind of guy that could work his way up as a starter and stay there.
Nice. Well, I hope the August roll continues for you guys. And this has been fun. We'll do it again soon.
Yeah, so do I.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. Again, anytime.
And here's Shannon Dreyer with Franklin Gutierrez.
Franklin, it was great to see you out on the field yesterday. And you step up and you have a big home run. When you have a couple of days off, what do you do to get yourself kind of back into the flow of things with the game, because you seem to not miss a step?
Yeah, well, you know, when you miss like a couple of games, like I did, because of flu symptoms, whatever, it just I was trying to do my routine. I was not trying to do too much, because when you have like 3 or 4 days you don't play, it's not the same when when you play every day. I guess just trying to do my routine and just prepare myself, knowing what kind of pitcher is going to be the guy who's going to pitch that day, and pretty much it, you know.
How much of a difference has that preparation made for you over the years, in knowing the pitcher and knowing what he's trying to do to you? Do you study different now than you did, say, 5 years ago?
We have a lot of reports, you know, and I think those reports help a lot. And I just sit in my locker and start watching those reports, and also when you see, we have video of the guy, so you have a knowledge on what he's going to throw for righties, and that's pretty much what I'm doing, just trying to concentrate in every game, and like I said, not trying to do too much. Like, when I say not trying to do too much, it's not trying to put pressure on myself, so that's what I'm trying to figure out every day.
How much pressure did you put on yourself when you hit that home run yesterday?
Nah, not much. Just I was having fun yesterday. I wanted to help my team yesterday. You know, I just put some good at bats there, and that's it.
Is that one you knew was out, or I mean, you got a lot of height on that.
I didn't know the ball was out for real. It was like it was too high. I knew I hit it a little good, but not enough to hit it out. But I was surprised that I hit it out. So it was good.
Hey, you know, back to the reports that you were talking about. What are the things that you like to look at? What do you focus in on?
Pretty much on what his best pitches, and how he works for the right-handed batters, So depending on how he works, he just just prepare myself on what pitch I'm gonna look early on the bat.
You know, when you first got here, you mentioned that when you were in Tacoma, Edgar came there for a couple of weeks and worked with everybody. What did he help you with specifically?
Pretty much on some drills, that I wasn't doing, and just to try and find my swing again. And I think, having those routines right now is helping me a lot. So I'm trying to do that every day and pretty much work on the team that I need to work.
Yesterday I talked with Jesus Montero, and he credited you as somebody who's really helped him out throughout the year. What do you see when you see him right now, and kind of how did you take interest in what he was doing?
Well, I think he works, really hard throughout the whole year, and obviously he deserves to be here. He's doing a great job, and he's always been a great hitter, he's still obviously in the process to keep learning a lot of stuff, and hopefully he will figure it out pretty soon.
Lastly, this is your locker. You're down in the Felix corner right now. Yeah. A little loud?
Not really. He's been pretty quiet lately, so, but it's good.
Good to know. Thank you, Franklin.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much.
And finally, Aaron Goldsmith sat down with a Hall of Famer. Here's Jim Palmer.
Jim, you made your Major League debut at the ripe age of 19 years old. A year later, 1966, you logged over 200 innings in the Major Leagues, and you faced Sandy Koufax in Game 2 of the World Series. You became the youngest pitcher ever to throw a complete game shutout. It ended up being Koufax's last game in the Major Leagues. What do you remember most about Game 2 of the World Series in 66, facing one of the greatest pitchers of all time?
Well, actually, I think it kind of started Game 1. Brooks and Frank Robinson hit home runs in the first inning, and you have to understand the Dodgers had played the Twins in 65 and won. They had won the World Series in 63 when they beat the Yankees. So when we went to California and played at Chevers Ravine, which is where the first two games were played, we were the underdogs. But Brooks and Frank hit home runs. Frank had been the most valuable player in the American League, Triple Crown winner. So they hit the back-to-back home runs, and I'm kind of standing, or really kind of come off my seat after the second home run. I said, gee, even at 20, we might have a chance to win this. So I kind of watched, and Dave McNally, who he and I were probably the two best starting pitchers. He was a little bit older, so he had a little more experience. But he started Game 1, and he was wild. In fact, he walked the bases loaded, and we brought in Mo Jabowski. He struck out 11 Dodgers in 6 2/3 innings, so I was paying attention. And, Mo was a guy we had gotten in the on waivers, $25,000, probably the best $25,000 the Orioles ever spent. And, had an incredible year. He came in, he's throwing low and away fastballs and nice little breaking ball, something that I had a curveball, but I didn't have his kind of slider. But he threw hard, and, you strike out 11 Dodgers in 6 2/3 innings. Even at 20, I was paying attention. So the only thing I really didn't want to do in Game 2 was, number one, get us out of the game early, which McNally had done because of his wildness. Number two, it was Sandy Koufax. I think he was like 25-7 or something with a 1.95 ERA. He was the best pitcher of that decade. And because of the Jewish holidays, he was pitching Game 2 instead of Game 1. And it's the first shutout I ever pitched. I might have pitched one in A ball, but I was so wild. I walked 2 years before. I'd walked 130 and 129 innings in A ball, and then they had to keep me in the big leagues when I was 19. So I hadn't pitched many shutouts, hadn't pitched many complete games. And, you know, that game, Sandy pitched very well, except Willie Davis dropped a couple of fly balls, picked up the second one because everybody knew he wasn't doing very well with a glove, and then heaved it into the stands, and we got some early runs. We would go on to win games 3 and 4, 1-0. Wally Bunker, who had been rookie pitcher of the year in 64, 19-5, had some arm problems, and then McNally came back and beat Drysdale on another Frank Robinson home run in game 4. So, you know, it was one of those great days, you know, where you're 20, you just go out there and compete. You know, it's kind of interesting, I think, when you're a bonus kid. I mean, didn't get a lot of money, but I got $40,000, which was a fairly good bonus back then. And, you know, my whole life, whether it was basketball or football or baseball, you always were playing with the big boys, and you're always trying to be a little bit better. And that World Series game, I was against the best pitcher in it. And like I said, Sandy pitched well. It's just that his defense let him down.
Jim, you had a phenomenal postseason career, especially in the World Series. You pitched in 6 of them, you won 3 rings, and you became the first pitcher ever to win 3 World Series games in 3 different decades. When you think back to your first World Series, to your last World Series, one as a pup, one as a veteran, how did you change, maybe mentally more than any, from your first World Series to your last?
Well, I don't really think you pitch any differently. You know, back in that era, we pitched a lot of complete games. We'd pitch every fourth day, and most years you would pitch in September and then October, you know, you'd feel the same. You know, the great thing, I mean, like when I got in the Hall of Fame, you know, I said the reason that I tried to be as good a pitcher as I was, you know, you're talking about a kid that used to go, when I lived in Los Angeles, I used to go to the Coliseum, and I used to chase foul balls when they played in the Coliseum before Shevitz Ravine. And, you know, I used to watch Wally Moon and, you know, some of the great Dodger teams. And I used to watch Koufax and Drysdale and, you know, Claude Osteen and, you know, who would pitch in World Series. So these guys set the standards. So you were always trying to meet or exceed those standards. And, you know, when I got to the Orioles and when I was 19, my roommate was Robin Roberts. Robin was 38, on his way to Cooperstown, one of the great pitchers for the Phillies, trying to win 300 games. And, you know, he mentored me. I used to put him to sleep asking him questions. And he'd finally say, kid, you know, hey, you know, you're 19, I'm 38, I got to get some rest. And we'll talk about this in the morning. But he was kind enough, even though I think he knew that I probably would take his job to do the mentoring stuff. So those are just the little nuances that you learn, I think, early on. And you know, of course, if you play almost 20 years like I did, that you kind of do that with, you know, Mike Flanagan. And, you know, I pitched with, 420-game winners, 320-game winners, pitched with a lot of great staffs. And you just try to convey that same message to the young guys that you play with.
Jim, you started the 1970 All-Star Game against Tom Seaver, and we bring up your two names. That All-Star game ended up producing 21 Hall of Famers, including, of course, the two starting pitchers. Known so much for the Ray Fosse-Pete Rose incident, but what were your memories of your first ever Major League All-Star game? Because the names of that All-Star game were just off the charts good.
Well, there's two things. Number one, Earl Weaver, I thought I'd go to Cincinnati that year, and I was 23, and, you know, I'd come off a torn rotator cuff, so, you know, once I was 16-4 the year before. So when they had the lunch, and Earl said I was going to be the next 30-game winner. And I had never won 20 games yet. Now, I would do it 8 out of the next 9 years. So that put a little pressure on me. So I just figured I'd go, and I maybe would pitch, but I'd sit there and watch McNally or, you know, Sam McDowell or, you know, Catfish Hunter. I mean, a lot of guys had more experience than me and hadn't been coming off a couple of years where I'd been hurt. But I was going to be the starting pitcher. I think Willie Mays led off and Rose hit second and bench. And, I mean, Dick Allen hit seventh in the lineup. Kind of gives you an idea of how good a lineup was. So the only time I ever had a migraine and headache. And the other thing is we had the luncheon, and I had a tan suit on and a kind of a light orange shirt with a flowered tie, which I think was in vogue back then. I'm not sure. But one of the writers said, you know, that tie is very much like the one Tom Seaver had on yesterday. And I said, well, actually, it was a gift from Tom for us letting him win the World Series last year because we had lost to the Mets, you know, in 1969, which was kind of an upset. I said, no, seriously. I said, I actually bought it in Cleveland. Come to think of it, there's really not much else to do in Cleveland. Oh, did I take some flack for that. So that's kind of what I remember. You know, I bunted off Seaver. Actually, I made it. It was a great bunt, and Pete Rose was playing third. He threw me out, and I come back to the bench, and Dave McNally, who would eventually, I don't know if he, yeah, I think he did pitch late in the ballgame. He goes, you know, you could have taken him deep because I was a pretty good hitter. I go, Jim Palmer take Tom Seaver? You're crazy. So, you know, again, it's the other thing. It was AstroTurf, and I had my spikes on before the turf shoes and all that. And the turf, it was pretty warm. And the day before the workout, I kept moving my feet because the heat was radiating up from the AstroTurf and going right through the metal to the bottom of your feet. So you wanted to have asbestos or something like that to protect your feet. So a lot of fine memories. But again, you know, facing Willie Mays, who swung at the first three, and every time I see him, Jim Bob, you were high, you were wild. And I said, well, that's why you swung at those three high fastballs, which is what he did, you know. And I mean, so to face him and Aaron and all those guys, I mean, you just really never forget about those kind of moments.
Jim, if you look over the course of your career of the Hall of Fame hitters that you face time and time and time again, you face Carl Yastrzemski more than anybody else. You look at other guys, Reggie Jackson, Rod Carew, Robin Yount, George Brett, Harmon Killebrew, the list just goes on and on. Who is it that when you think back on your career that you really enjoyed facing more than anyone else?
Well, actually, you know, there's a name in there. When I hurt my shoulder, I was down in Elmira, New York in 1968, and I would lose to Steve Klein 1-0. And I was throwing about 80, you know, when I used to throw in the, you know, mid-90s to upper 90s. And Thurman Munson came up from the Yankees, and he hit a ball that hit the right field chalk line. And, you know, I ended up losing 1-0. And, you know, Thurman obviously tragically died, I think, 1979, and then, you know, plane crash when he was an off day. But, you know, I mean, I faced, you know, Clemente probably would have been the toughest guy. But Thurman was one of those guys. And I used to play in the American Airlines golf tournaments where you'd have baseball player and football players, and you'd be with people that used American Airlines for either, you know, freight or their companies or whatever. And Thurman and I would always kind of get to know each other. But we could put that friendship aside when he'd walk to home plate. He'd kind of give me a wink, and then you'd go to war. And, you know, he beat me 2-0 and, you know, hit a home run when the Yankees were playing in Shea Stadium while they were redoing Yankee Stadium. And while you didn't want that to happen, I just had so many respect, not only for Thurman, but for all the guys that you talk about and everybody else. You know, you look at a lineup and, you know, if you're playing the Yankees and you see Reggie and Nettles and some of those guys, you go, okay, well, maybe I can get this guy out. I better get that guy out. And, you know, I always thought that, you know, Brett was a tough out. You know, he played on, you know, Willie Wilson got 230 hits and McRae was one of the best DHs. And, you know, John Mayberry played on that team. You know, a lot of the teams, you go to Boston and they'd have, you know, Fisk and Yaz and Rice all in the Hall of Fame. You go to Detroit, they'd have seven guys that hit 20 or more home runs. We had some pretty good hitting ball clubs, but the challenge was, you know, one day I lost in Detroit 3-2, and, you know, it's 45,000 people, and I'm out there. I did want to win that day, but I'm thinking, is there any place I really would rather be? You know, so again, I just think the fact that, you come up as a, you know, dreaming about it. I went to Yankee Stadium when I was 9 years old, just like Billy Crystal did. And we, you know, it was a before color television and walked in on a Tuesday night and it rained. And I never realized how green the grass was. 10 years later, I would come in with the bases loaded in relief when I first year in the big league, strike out Mantle, Maris, and Howard on 12 pitches. And be able to do that for almost 20 years was pretty special. And then, you know, the fact that my parents, who were, I mean, being adopted, they were instrumental in directing me to sign with the Orioles because I was a year before the draft. Things seem to work out pretty well.
Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being so gracious with your time.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
See you later!